In 1932, when director Marion Cooper was shooting a film called The Most Dangerous Game, he approached his leading lady about a role in a new movie he was planning.
He said, "You're going to have the tallest, darkest leading man in Hollywood."
Fay Wray hoped he was referring to Cary Grant. He wasn't. His leading man actually wasn't very tall at all, about 18 inches high, but on screen, he was colossal.
Did you ever hear of Kong?
Now, 75 years after its premiere, there's hardly anyone who hasn't heard of King Kong. For our series In Character about famous American fictional icons, Robert Maleski profiles one of film's most enduring creations.
I was a little timid boy. Put that on your tape if you want. But made myself be a champion boxer and wrestler and fought 3 successful wars. I'm King Kong.
That was Marion Cooper, the man who created King Kong. He might have said he was King Kong, but most people who know Cooper's life and the groundbreaking film he made think he was much more like another character in that movie, Carl Denham, the man who leads the expedition to Skull Island in search of the legendary beast. Like Denham, Cooper and his partner Ernest Shedsack were adventurers who traveled the world filming documentaries in remote corners of the globe. And like Denham, when Cooper set his mind to something, he let nothing get in his way. In 1931, he got it in his head to make a gorilla picture. No one was interested, except David O. Selznick at RKO.
This picture took a year to make, and RKO was short of money, very short. Now, David played one vital part. He was the only human being that backed me up 100%. And he never looked at the rushes. He didn't know what the hell I was doing. Everybody thought it was nuts. And everybody wanted me to put a man in a gorilla suit. And it would have been just horrible.
King Kong was a huge hit in 1933 and saved RKO from bankruptcy. The reasons for its popularity were numerous. Groundbreaking animation by special effects master Willis O'Brien. A majestic historic score by composer Max Steiner. A solid cast featuring iconic screamer Fay Wray, and a great storyline of high adventure whose main theme was specifically outlined in the film.
Miss Darrow's the story. If it hadn't been for her, we couldn't have gotten near Kong. He followed her back to the village. Beauty and the Beast, huh? That's it. Play up that angle. Beauty and the Beast. Kong could have stayed safe where he was, but he couldn't stay away from Beauty. That's your story, boys.
That's a story, all right.
The Beauty and Beast theme is repeated over and over throughout the film, but it's easy to read other, sometimes darker themes into King Kong. The racial aspect of the original movie is unavoidable.
I think most people who know the film would say, to one degree or another, that it is a racist film.
Cynthia Erb is the director of film studies at Wayne State University and the author of Tracking King Kong, a Hollywood icon in world culture.
At that time in the early 30s, the jungle genre like Tarzan was very popular. So there were a lot of movies set in kind of exotic locations. And the depiction of natives was often, you know, patronizing, stereotypical, racist. I think it does happen with the Skull Islanders.
Marlum! Marlum Avocado!
What's that? He says, look at the golden woman.
Yeah, blondes are scarce around here.
There is certainly an interpretation of King Kong himself as an extension of the Skull Islanders, as a black character that is also racist. In my opinion, it always has this other dimension that focuses so much on King Kong as a victim and on the Carl Denham character as a real intruder, as a certain type who really is very clueless about the space that he's conquering. So for me, that always kind of complicates the argument, but there certainly are different ways of reading the film.
And it wasn't just race. Women come in for their share of disrespect as well.
Holy mackerel, do you think I want to haul a woman around? Then why?
Because the public, bless them, must have a pretty face to look at.
Sure, everybody likes romance.
Well, isn't there any romance or adventure in the world without having a flapper in it?
But as Carl Denham just said, they needed the woman for the film, especially for what comes later. Once the scene shifts from New York to Skull Island, King Kong hums with an undercurrent of eroticism. There's bondage imagery and a very famous disrobing scene where Kong slowly peels away Andaro's dress, then holds it up to his nose and sniffs.
I've read fans who quote Cooper as saying that moment is supposed to be about peeling petals from a rose.
Cynthia Erb.
I think Cooper did not want people to look at the film that way. But King Kong is famously a pre-code film. And despite what Cooper and Shodzak said, I feel that that use of Skull Island as a very kind of erotic landscape, and Faye Ray was a very sexy actress, so that I feel that there's a definite eroticism there. I kind of think that he stands for a strange kind of animal love.
The unasked question in the movie is about, well, sex. What exactly does Kong intend to do with his captive girl? It's a question Cooper biographer Mark Cotta-Vaz thinks the filmmaker never even contemplated. He spoke to WHYY's Fresh Air in 2005.
It's something that people will debate. I mean, there is this one book that came out that talked about the whole rape thing, you know, and Marion Cooper and Dorothy Jordan were a great couple, and they were worldly people, but they were pretty conservative, and, you know, he was a good Southern gentleman, and just the idea of people talking like that, I always had this image of Cooper just cringing, you know, because I honestly don't think that was his intent. I think it was more the idea of beauty being totally vulnerable. It's maybe less a bondage thing as it was just exposing her. He wanted to do a sacrificial ritual thing. She's put out there to be sacrificed.
To many, the eroticism and racism of the original film are just side themes and part of the fabric of 1930s America. King Kong deals with larger themes as well. Washington Post critic Tom Shales.
I think it's a great 20th century story in which we confront our own primal origins, try to imagine civilizing them, which is in effect a kind of corruption of them, and then tragedy is the result. I don't think beauty killed the beast. I don't think that's at all the moral of the tale, even though that was stated and restated throughout the whole movie. I think it's more of an allegory about modern man facing his own nature.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
The film historian and critic Richard Schickel said that one of the reasons a work of popular art endures is because it has unanswered questions and people can read things into it. That's certainly true of King Kong. But at its heart, it's a timeless adventure story. Yet the question remains, what was it about the character of Kong himself that drew audiences to him? Cynthia Erb believes it's the work done by animator Willis O'Brien, who made Kong real, human, and larger than life, despite the restrictions of stop-motion animation.
In reality, this is an 18-inch puppet, and I think that Willis O'Brien was amazingly able to animate this creature so that he, in fact, seems to stand several stories high. It's very believable. He was just a genius at animation, and a lot of the things that spell King Kong, his hugeness, his rebellions, his love, his animal qualities, have to do with O'Brien's obsessive, very careful way of bringing him to life.
O'Brien, Cooper, and Shedzak tried to capitalize on their success by releasing a sequel, Son of Kong, the same year as the original. But they couldn't recreate the magic. Others, most recently Peter Jackson in 2005, have also tried with varying degrees of success. The remakes and a raft of other minor Kong movies over the decades only serve to highlight the power of the 1933 original. For film fans everywhere, Marion Cooper's Kong will always remain the king, the eighth wonder of the world. For NPR News, I'm Robert Molesky.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hancock, the big-budget holiday weekend movie opening tomorrow, stars Will Smith as a reluctant, rude, unpopular superhero. Our guest, Jason Bateman, co-stars as Ray, a public relations expert who takes on the abrasive Hancock as a client after the superhero rescues him. The movie also co-stars Charlize Theron as Ray's wife and is directed by Peter Berg, who produced both the movie and TV versions of Friday Night Lights. Jason Bateman has drawn acclaim recently for small but impressive supporting roles in such movies as Juno, in which he and Jennifer Garner played the couple planning to adopt Juno's baby, and Smoke and Aces. Those roles came after his 2003 TV showcase role in the Fox sitcom Arrested Development. He starred as Michael Bluth, the one seemingly sane character surrounded by a gaggle of crazy family members. But long before that, Jason Bateman tasted stardom as a child, beginning in the early 80s with regular roles on Little House on the Prairie and Silver Spoons. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke to Jason Bateman. Let's start with a clip from Hancock. After the drunken Hancock saves Ray, Jason Bateman's character, Ray invites Hancock over for dinner with his wife and son.
Aaron, pal, how was school today, huh?
Fine.
Yeah, no more problems with that bully Michael?
Michelle.
Michelle is this neighborhood bully.
We've been trying to teach Aaron a little bit about conflict resolution.
Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, turn the other cheek, all
that's
that.
That's exactly right.
Well, just never turn that one, all right? Never let them punk you.
Got it.
Okay, Aaron, eat your food.
Well, you deal with bullies, you take your right foot, bring it right up, catch him in his little...
Please,
little
just stop. Michelle is not a man, okay? He's a little boy, and his parents happen to be going through a really, really bad divorce, and that's why he's acting up. And maybe you don't know this, but not everything in this world gets resolved with brute force. Not everything has to be bang, scream, blood, more blood, you know,
Angel,
just destruction.
Okay. She watches so much news that sometimes it gets to be a little too much.
You got a toilet?
Yep. Yeah, just pass the fridge.
Did he just take the whiskey bottle to the bathroom?
Do you want him to kill us all?
Jason Bateman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Your new movie is Hancock. It stars Will Smith in the title role, and he's playing a guy with superpowers, but a very bad attitude and reputation. And you play Ray, a public relations guy who tries to polish Hancock's image. I was really surprised when I saw a preview of the movie that you were as much the leading man as Will Smith was. I mean, it's your character's story as much as it is his. So how did you get this role, and how long ago did you know you had it?
Well, I did a film with Peter Berg called The Kingdom, and we were working together for quite some time, and you can accrue quite a number of incriminating photos on somebody when, when you're spending that much time with them. So I cashed those in for this part.
You have said that you have sort of a plan for building stardom the second time, you know, going for roles that aren't necessarily above the title but that appeal to you. And you can see that plan in Juno. I was really impressed by the shadings that you gave to that character, which starts off as a very likable character and needs to be a very likable character, and then slowly turns over the course of the movie. That seems like, even on paper, it would have been a wonderful role to play. But I wonder, was it a wonderful role to think about how to play?
Yeah, you know, reading the script, there's a final scene, or sort of the peak scene for my character with Juno, where we're dancing in this basement, and things get a little creepy, and I let her know that I'm leaving my wife, and the dialogue as written, as read, points you, the reader, and me, the actor, trying to figure out who this guy is and what his intentions are in all the scenes preceding this, in a particular direction, a direction of, well, I think he might be trying to hit on this girl. And Jason Reitman, the director, he and I, we had discussions about this quite a bit leading up to shooting that scene through the rehearsal process and in all the days of shooting before we got to that day. And I wanted to know, am I trying to sleep with this girl? Am I trying, you know, am I hitting on her? Mm-hmm. Or am I just looking for a peer relationship, sort of a connection? Because if it is the latter, then that informs how I play the scenes beforehand with my wife. And if it is the former, that's going to inform how I play the scenes with Juno. That precede that scene. So,
well, before you say which way you've decided, let's hear the scene. This is Jason Bateman and Ellen Page in Juno.
I'm leaving, Vanessa.
What?
Getting a place in the city, got it all planned. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time.
No.
No?
No, you definitely can't do that. That's one big fat sack of... No.
What is the matter?
I mean, you guys are supposed to take care of this, you know?
Thought you'd be cool with this.
Cool. I want things to be perfect. I don't want them to be shitty and broken like everyone else's family. God, look, I'll have the baby, and Vanessa's gonna be so happy. You just... The
baby's not gonna fix everything. Besides, I don't know if I'm even ready to be a father.
But you're old.
How do you think of me? You know, why are you over here?
I just like being a piece of furniture in your weird life.
This is what my life has become. I mean, you know, I got stuff in boxes, you know, I'm underground. That's appealing to you?
Is this my fault?
No.
Is Vanessa, like, mad at you because of me or something?
It's got nothing to do with it. Vanessa and I aren't in love anymore.
Well, you were in love when you married her. And if you're in love once, you can be in love again. Like my friend Leah, who's been with the same guy, like... four different times. You're just not trying hard enough.
Such an idiot. I can't believe what an idiot.
No, you know what, Mark? Just do not divorce your wife. Will you please just do me a solid and stay with Vanessa?
You're so young.
All right. So what did you decide? How did you decide to play it?
Basically, the short answer is I went for a 70-30 sort of ratio there between, and the 70 being going for a friendship and a connection there as a result of being lonely in my marriage. And the 30% was somewhat more, you know, lascivious, but only perhaps developing maybe 2 or 3 months down the road. So it came as a result of the conversations with Jason Reitman, the director, and trying to figure out what we should be playing here. Now, he was consistently saying to me, I'd like for you to play both. I understood where he was coming from, and ultimately that did work. But it was frustrating to me as an actor that I didn't want to get caught in no man's land, and I needed to know which side he wanted me to be, and then from there I would play it somewhat vague or ambiguous. So he ended up saying to me, "Well, you know, why don't you just decide and just know what my desires are?" And so the way that we went about doing it was, we shot the scene, that particular scene, about, I don't know, let's say 10 times. It might have actually been exactly 10. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, in the first take, I'm going to play as meek and as vulnerable and as solicitous of friendship with her as possible. And by the 10th take, I will be a real creep. And, you know, I will come across like I'm trying to, you know, make it all happen right there on the couch right then. And the agreement was that once he gets in the editing room, he would cobble together a performance out of those 10 takes. And he did that. And I thank him so much for putting the scene together like that and helping me execute that fence riding that he wanted so badly.
When you're on a set with Ellen Page in Juno or any other young actor, because you were a child star, do you have or do you resist the temptation to dispense advice?
I don't resist, but really I haven't had to do that with anybody. You know, Michael's got his head firmly screwed on and is not a real Hollywood guy at all. And I don't know. It's such a tough business for adults. And if you're a kid, it's even tougher. There's a lot of people that are allowing you to be a brat, and the more sort of psychological side of it. is somewhat dangerous too, in that you are trying to learn how to be different people at a time when you haven't yet figured out who you are. Mm-hmm. And that can generate some schizophrenia. Yeah, I mean, depending on how good you are at it and how sort of deep you want to go in that, in the process, you can kind of mess yourself up. I had some confusing years. I mean, I don't want to say that I developed schizophrenia, but I certainly found a lot of different parts of myself that were becoming very, very fully developed, different personalities that I could justify wearing and living when I might not be instinctually feeling them. So, you know, just rolling out of bed and living with the mood that you are instinctively in sometimes was a challenge. And I had a tough time holding on to teachers. You know, I went through a long list of studio teachers. It got to a point where they wouldn't even send one to the set and sort of shut down at one point.
And these are one-on-one tutors, right? So when you're...
Yeah, yeah. So there was nowhere to hide when I was being a little bastard. There's a lot of brats out there, and I was certainly one of them.
Well, Jason Bateman, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jason Bateman speaking with our TV critic, David Bianculli.
Back now with Day to Day. Tonight is the NBA draft. Four of the players expected to be drafted are featured in a new documentary about elite high school basketball. That movie is called Gunnin' for That Number One Spot.
I'm a self-starter. I wanted to get in the gym and work. I wanted to change myself.
Having a work ethic.
That's where I think I get my competitive edge from.
Is it talent?
You know, just a certain attitude, a certain killer instinct that these high school kids have.
You are treated like a star.
He's a man child. He can do whatever he wants.
It doesn't help them grow up in a normal way.
Normal for these kids means constant scrutiny from scouts and from the media. They are showered with sponsorships from major sneaker companies. It's a lot of pressure for an adult, let alone for a teenager.
The film's director is Adam Yauch. He's best known as MCA in the group The Beastie Boys. And Adam joins me now from our New York studios. Welcome to Day to Day.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine, thanks. Well, tell us more about that relationship, companies, sneaker companies, and other corporate interests scoping out and trying to sign up high school kids.
Yeah, I mean, there's even talk that they're looking at junior high school kids because it's so valuable to them. They need to find that next Michael Jordan.
So they sign them up. What do they want in return?
Well, they can't really sign them at that age. But what they do is they kind of become like sponsored by these companies. So you become like an Adidas kid, and that means you go to the Adidas camp and you play on the Adidas team and you play in the Adidas All-Star game. And then those sneaker companies are hoping that when you go professional and you're allowed to actually accept money, because they're not allowed to accept money until they go professional because it disqualifies them, that when they do that, they'll go with that company when they actually do make that contract.
And then your film, it profiles these eight young men, and then it follows them into this basketball tournament that happens every year in Harlem at the Rucker Playground. I'm wondering if you could describe that for people who don't know about Rucker, how important that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think this tournament was amazing for a number of reasons. One of them is that the sneaker affiliations are not an issue. Most of the time when you have these all-star games, it's all just the Adidas, you know, All-Star Game or the Nike All-Star Game. And normally it's by class, like it'll just be the seniors. So to have an All-Star Game that's the best players in the country, regardless of their, you know, their age or their affiliation, the top high school players in the country is amazing. And then the fact that it's taking place at Rucker Park in Harlem, people refer to it as the Mecca of basketball. It's like a place that ball players feel like they need to visit.
Talk to me about the way the movie looks, because it struck me it was almost like you were editing the movie on a turntable, you know,
yeah.
Because you have like a lot of fast forward and then rewinds, particularly of the basketball scenes.
Yeah.
What were you trying to
achieve? Was just something. I mean, it does come from hip hop in a way. Like a lot of times when you're listening to a hip hop station and they're playing a record and they play like the beginning of the first verse and the first verse sounds really solid, and, you know, someone will say, rewind that, play that again. And they'll just kind of spin it backwards and you hear it roll back and then they just play that verse again. And I felt that way with the basketball. Like sometimes you'd see something fly by and just be like, whoa, rewind, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we did that, kind of find different ways to explore a play that was interesting.
And some of those plays are unbelievable. I mean, when you really see what they're doing, it's balletic.
Yeah. That's what my dad said, actually, because my dad hates sports. My dad gets the New York Times delivered in the morning, opens it up, takes the sports section out, and throws it in the garbage can like it ruined his paper or something. But that's what he said, was that it almost reminded him of some kind of like dance, like the way that the guys moved.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
That's Adam Yauch. He's director of the new movie Gunnin' for that number one spot. It's a documentary.
The digital animators at Pixar have already brought movie life to toys, bugs, monsters, fish, superheroes, cars, and rats. Today they're adding robots to that list in a science fiction fantasy called WALL-E. As with all Pixar pictures, WALL-E is designed to appeal to children. But our critic Bob Mondello says grown-ups, even film historians, will be intrigued.
The camera descends at the start of the film from outer space to a landscape that looks eerily familiar, and sort of not. The sun filters down through a brownish haze. What look at first like skyscrapers turn out to be neatly stacked mountains of trash. Stillness is everywhere, broken only by the unlikely sound of a song from Hello, Dolly, and a solitary figure zipping through a junk-strewn cityscape. Apparently, humans never changed course on pollution and consumerism, and sometime in the 22nd century, they had to leave a planet that they had turned into a giant garbage dump, without turning off a robot they had left behind. He's basically a trash compactor on treads, a waste allocation load lifter, WALL, Earth Class E, WALL-E, who has, over the course of 700 years... developed a personality. He picks up junk and wonders what it's for. A Rubik's Cube, a spork, an electronic key. Some of it he saves, say an alarmingly fresh 700-year-old Twinkie for his pet cockroach, but most of the trash he compacts and stacks, and that's his routine until one day he falls head over treads for a sleek robot from the stars. Eve, an extraterrestrial vegetation evaluator, whom he watches from afar so he won't be incinerated. She has an itchy trigger finger. The first hour of WALL-E is a crazily inventive, deliriously engaging, and almost wordless silent comedy of the sort that Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton used to make. Things turn more conventional in the last half hour when pudgy, machine-dependent humans make an appearance, but the glow of that first part will carry you through. That and the majesty of the filmmaking, WALL-E's world in all its epic decay looks real. You can almost taste the dust. And it's emotionally real, too, enough so that a cautionary tale about the environment and about big corporations that don't take care of it and about getting so caught up in our gadgetry that we forget to look at the stars all takes a back seat to romance.
WALL-E!
Some specifically cinematic subtexts also take a back seat. Director Andrew Stanton and his animators have slipped in nods not just to Hello, Dolly, but to R2-D2 and Blade Runner, and Inconvenient Truth and the comedies of Jacques Tati and Chaplin. More than just a nod to Chaplin, actually, WALL-E, with his workaholic scruffiness and his yearning for someone to hold hands with, might as well be Chaplin's Little Tramp. There's actually a nice parallel between this film and Chaplin's first sound film, Modern Times. In that one, the silent clown used the soundtrack mostly for music and effects, not for speech, just as Pixar does here for most of the film. Chaplin only lets you hear a human voice a couple of times, and only on some sort of mechanical contraption, say a TV screen, to emphasize its artificiality. It was his way of saying to the sound world, okay, everybody's doing this talking thing now, but look how much more elegant our silent world is. For the first time in a Pixar movie, WALL-E's filmmakers have actual actors filmed with cameras on screen, and it makes them artificial in the same way, by only letting you see them on video screens, and they look flat and washed out compared to the digital world around them. But there's a difference. Chaplin knew he had lost the battle. Silence was finished. Sound had won. But in today's Hollywood, digital is what's taking over. And Pixar's animators, bless them, are at the forefront, insisting that imagery created on computers does not have to be soulless. WALL-E's images are filled with emotion, just as Silent Film's images were. The film is being sold as a futuristic fantasy, but I have to say I am just as gratified that WALL-E's filmmakers looked back 70 years to silent movies as I am that they looked forward 700 years to a silent planet. I'm Bob Mandello.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.